I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. If Bernie Sanders becomes president, median income in the U.S. could reach more than $82,000 per year, an increase of $30,000 over current levels. 26 million jobs could be created, especially in renewable energy and rebuilding our failing infrastructure. If that isn't enough for you, how about this? Poverty could plummet to a record low of 6%, while our $1.3 trillion deficit would turn into a big surplus by President Sanders' second term. Pie in the sky? Rainbows and unicorns? Not according to economist Gerald Friedman. We spoke to Friedman a few weeks ago about the economics of Senator Sanders' Medicare for All plan. That plan is based on Friedman's analysis of projected cost savings of single-payer health insurance in several states and nationally. You can hear that interview online at writersvoice.net. Friedman's work on single-payer is just one element of a much more comprehensive analysis he's conducted of the economic impact of Bernie Sanders' platform. Sanders has been accused by the Clinton camp of lacking specifics, but anybody who goes to BernieSanders.com, the campaign website, can find a wealth of specifics. Gerald Friedman has delved into them in detail, as you'll hear if you listen to the entire interview. If you want to skip how he did his economic analysis to just hear about the results, listen to the edited version. Well, Gerald Friedman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you gave CNN Money an exclusive report on what would happen to income and jobs if Bernie Sanders became president. They said that it was the first comprehensive look at the impact of all of Sanders' spending and tax proposals on the economy. Could you say a little bit about how you went about doing this?
It started with the Wall Street Journal a few months ago published a piece claiming that Bernie Sanders' economic programs would cost $15 trillion or something like that. $18 trillion. And I was mentioned in that. And I said to a friend that, you know, if they had done dynamic modeling, recognizing that the Sanders program would contribute to faster economic growth and thereby generate more tax revenue, then they would have used a lower number. Plus, faster economic growth would reduce spending on other things like food stamps and unemployment insurance. So she suggested, oh, why don't you do that? And naively, I said, oh, sure. All I need to do is come up with a couple of multipliers and plug some numbers in, and it will be fine. From there, I embarked on actually working out what he is proposing, which eventually I had to go to the campaign with a list of, I think these are his programs, and this is how much each of them is costing. And they, you know, edited that for me, saying, no, we're not proposing this, but we're also proposing something else. And then I had to work out his taxes, what his tax proposals are. Once I had taxes and spending, I estimated for each of them how much effect they would have on the gross domestic product, with the idea that if the government spends money, gives money for infrastructure, say, to construction workers, those construction workers will then go and spend that money buying, you know, maybe boats or fishing rods or food. And the people they give that money to will then spend the money buying other things for themselves. And that's how it multiplies through the economy. The Congressional Budget Office has worked out formulae for those multipliers. And I basically used their model, their formula, you know, the value of the multipliers that they have. And then I did the same thing for taxes, because when the government takes money from people for taxes, those people cut back on their spending by varying amounts. And when they cut back on spending, people they would have spent money buying things from have less money in their hands. So they cut back on spending and it goes the kind of the reverse of the taxes of the spending program. So I worked out those multipliers and get a net effect, which is a fairly rapid increase in economic growth under the Sanders program. Then I had to figure out, well, how many jobs would be created? And again, I used fairly conventional estimates of something called the Oken coefficient, which is the ratio of employment increases to increases in gross domestic product. When the economy gets bigger, when businesses are producing more stuff, they hire more people. From there, I went to unemployment rates, because if all these people are getting jobs, some of them are coming out of the unemployed. Some of them are coming out of people who are not looking for jobs right now because they've given up looking. The country is filled with millions of people who had jobs 10 years ago, but don't now, and don't count themselves as unemployed because they've given up. And I had to make estimates of immigration, because when the economy expands, more people come to the United States to work. So working through all those, I got the unemployment rate. And once I had the unemployment rate, I made estimates of wages. And then I had to go back to the Sanders program because he has proposals that will directly affect wages independent of the condition of the economy, such as an increase in the minimum wage. So I had to work all that out, figure out how many people will get an increase in wages because of the minimum wage, how much will their wages go up, and factor that into the wages, how many people will lose their job because of the higher minimum wage, and I had to make estimates of how much will prices change because of higher minimum wages. So I worked all that out, got a rate of inflation, and then there's some other regulatory programs like card check unionism, you know, where unions would be organized if you could get enough people to sign a card at a workplace. So I worked all those out, figured out how much effect they would have on wages, and then went back to the employment figures because some of these wage increases will lower employment. And then once I had wages, employment, income, then I estimated poverty. You know, working into that estimate, the effect of the Sanders increase in the minimum benefit for Social Security. Then when I had poverty, unemployment, wages, tax revenues, expenditures, I worked out the federal budget deficit, and finally, income inequality, because I had a figure, I have figures now for how many people will be working, what their wages will be, what taxes will be, and that gives me income for people at the bottom. And because I estimate the distribution of who's going to be paying these taxes based on data from the IRS, I also have the tax burden on the wealthiest people. So I have changes in income for the richest, changes in income for the poorest, and that gives me a new measure of the income inequality.
Wow, that sounds very comprehensive. And
my spreadsheets it's kind of fun because some of these spreadsheets are, as you might imagine from what I've been saying, are interconnected. So I can sometimes put in one change and I'll watch all these graphs moving, the lines moving all over. It's almost acrobatic. It's as close as an economist ever gets to a dancer's grace.
Now, that's an amazing number of variables that you've put in there. And let's just now boil it down to what some of those calculations came up with. One of the first things I saw in the CNN Money article was that median income would go up by $22,000. That seems huge. And in fact, you estimate that median household income would be $82,000 by 2026. And that is far higher than the $59,000 projected by the Congressional Budget Office. First of all, tell us, why was your calculation, why does it come out to so much more than the CBO?
Okay, well, there are two things I put into this estimate. First is, I started with the CBO baseline for 2014 When I was doing this, we didn't have 2015 data yet. So I start with 2014 median income. I assume median income will increase at the rate of increase in per capita income, real per capita income, not, you know, factoring out inflation. That's also important because I have a higher inflation rate for the Sanders program, so I have to make sure I'm using the right one. I increase both of them by the rate of increase in the per capita income. So that gets you, well, for the CBO, it gets you from $53,000 for household income in 2014 to $59,000, which is, you know, reflects the increase in real per capita income that the CBO is assuming. That's not a big number. You know, the CBO is actually fairly pessimistic in what they're looking at for the economy over the next 10 years. Sanders, you start at $53,000, but we have a higher rate of increase in per capita income. So that gets you to $73,000. So you have $14,000 increase in median income under the Sanders plan because of faster economic growth. But there's also the tax program, which is taking money that people are now spending in particular on health insurance premiums. Health insurance premiums are a heavy burden on working and middle-class Americans. Think about it. If you have a health insurance plan for your family that costs $20,000 and you have an average family with an income of $55,000, your health insurance is costing almost 40% of your family income. Take that away and replace it with taxes that are 6% of your wages and 2% of your income, which is the Sanders tax program to finance health insurance, then you have a major saving. On the other hand, when we get to the income for the very richest, they are, okay, they're saving some money on the health insurance premiums, like everybody else, but there are a lot of other taxes that are being put in here. Sanders is proposing major progressive tax increases that will be almost exclusively borne by the richest Americans. But for middle-income Americans, they're just getting a big benefit because, you know, primarily because of the health insurance premiums. So factor that in, the change in taxes and premiums, and you get another $6,000 increase on median household income. So that gets you to over $80,000 for the Sanders plan. No change in median household income coming from taxes and other regulatory programs in the CBO program. So that's where you get the $20,000 gain for the Sanders under the Sanders plan. Mostly, you know, 2/3 economic growth or 3/4 economic growth, fast economic growth, and the rest from redistributing the burden of taxes. And when I say taxes, I'm including private health insurance premiums. We are required by law to have health insurance. So as I see it, Cigna, Blue Cross Blue Shield, all these, they are collecting taxes. They're private taxes. They're not going to the government, but they're going to a government-required program, which makes them taxes.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with economist Gerald Friedman about a report he wrote and released to CNN Money on the economic impact of a Bernie Sanders presidency. Friedman's work on single-payer health insurance forms a basis of the Sanders Medicare for All plan. Now, you also say that the nation's $1.3 trillion deficit would turn into a large surplus by Sanders' second term. Is that because of the taxes?
It's about half because of taxes and about half because of changes in faster economic growth. Again, the faster economic growth will mean that there's more money in the economy to be taxed. And so, you know, your income goes up, you pay more in taxes. You still have a higher income. Everybody's still better off. But there's more government revenue. Also, and this is a smaller part of it, there's less government spending because of faster economic growth. You know, programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit will go down in size. Pell Grants, when we have free college, free public college, a lot of Pell Grant spending will go away because people don't need the Pell Grants for their tuition. There'll still be Pell Grants, because there are other expenses going to college. There'll still be some of these spending programs, but there'll be a lot less. By the way, the increase in the minimum wage especially reduces spending on the earned income tax credit. There's a big trade-off there. Okay, so we have more revenue from faster growth, less spending because of faster growth, and we have the Sanders tax program, which really starts to kick in at the highest income levels. And that, you know, the combination by 2021, 2022 has basically eliminated the federal government deficit, which is quite a contrast. As I said, the CBO is fairly conservative in its prognosis. I don't know why they're so conservative. I think that even with current economic program policies, I think they're too conservative. But one result of them being so conservative is they are projecting very, very large deficits in the future. A couple years ago, there was a whole big to-do with the Bowles-Simpson committee, you remember, which said, oh, we need to slash Social Security and Medicare because the old people are driving up the deficit. That, I think, was overblown, but it comes from the very conservative assumptions made by the CBO.
Well, that's pretty high growth. 5.3% for a developed economy is quite high. And I guess I'd like to ask you, I mean, we are, after all, our economy is connected to a global economy. So it can't just operate based on policies that are enacted at the national level. So how do you justify this level of growth, and are you taking into effect the possibility of, you know, of crises that may develop on the global scale?
As far as general crises, no. I'm assuming, you know, conditions will be stable, which is what the CBO assumes. You know, if we get into what sort of crises could be happening, I mean, it's, you can get any result you want because nobody, almost by definition, the crises are unpredictable. We could have a financial meltdown in 2 years. And as far as that goes, though, I do think the Sanders plan will reduce the danger of crisis by more tightly regulating the financial sector, which has been the site, you know, of economic crises. Also by reducing inequality. We've had this rising gap between rich and poor, and the economy has been more and more dependent on the spending, either debt finance spending by the mass of the population or, you know, luxury spending by a relatively small number of very, very, very rich people. As wealth is spread to more Americans, we will be reducing the dependence on those anomalous, really anomalous sources of effective demand. So I think the danger of crises will be lowered. Now, you're absolutely right that the rate of economic growth that I'm projecting is high. But keep in mind, the 1960s, we had almost 5% per annum real growth in GDP. All I'm talking about is going back to economic conditions of full employment and rapid economic growth that we've had before. Now, I did factor in, you're absolutely right, again, that this is fast economic growth in one isolated country, which will lead to increases in imports relative to exports, because unless the Europeans follow us, you know, and adopt a program like Sanders, which I'd be delighted if they would, and the Canadians, if they follow along with us. But assuming that they continue with their current policies, we will have a rising trade deficit. And that will slow the economy, which I factored in by, remember those multipliers. You know, the CBO had a multiplier of like 2 in 2009 with the Obama stimulus. I'm projecting a multiplier of less than 1 starting in 2017, because the economy has recovered a lot from 2009. So the multiplier would be lower. There's less room for growth. And I project that the multiplier will drop to about 0.5 by the end of the Sanders term. So spending will have much less effect promoting growth, partly because more and more excess spending will be going to imports. We'll be helping Europe and Canada. And It may lead to a devaluation of the dollar. That's certainly possible. The dollar is the world's reserve currency, and it seems the world has a almost insatiable demand for more dollars. So, yeah, there may be implications for monetary policy there. But I don't quite go, I don't go into those in too much detail, except a little bit in some footnotes.
So basically, your plan, it's basically a stimulatory plan, just like the Obama stimulus was.
Except bigger and longer. Yeah. It's the Obama stimulus we should have had in 2009.
So now I have a question that's kind of stepping outside this frame, which is, you know, we live in a world in which, you know, which is finite in resources. And there are many people who are saying that the value, the idea that we can grow forever without basically overshooting our planet's capacity to support us is crazy. How do you put the idea of economic growth under a President Sanders within the context of moving to a more sustainable economy?
Well, that's excellent points that you're making. You're absolutely right, of course. We need to address the limits, the physical limits of our planet's carrying capacity. Fortunately, the Sanders program actually does that. Again, building on what's already been started under Obama, where we've had a very good beginning in shifting towards solar power and a sustainable carbon policy, energy policy. Sanders has a significant carbon tax, most of which will be 80% will be rebated to consumers, and the rest will be used for to fund environmental programs, retrofitting of homes and schools, the infrastructure program, the $1 trillion infrastructure program that is at the core of his spending program, that is focused on energy, on solar, wind, geothermal, and projects to increase energy efficiency with mass transit, as well as, again, retrofitting homes, building solar installations on homes and the whole and the like. So Sanders is talking, his plan is to move very aggressively towards a more sustainable economy. And another piece of this is promoting greater economic equity. It's unsustainable for rich Americans and America as a rich country to say to the rest of the world, or rich Americans to say to other Americans, that you have to sacrifice so that I can continue to overconsume. A more balanced, a more equitable economy, I think, is really necessary for us to have an effective climate policy, because if we're all going to be making sacrifices, we all have to feel that we have a fair shake in what we've got, in the way the economy operates. Environmental justice is absolutely necessary for a sustainable economic policy and environmental policy. If we don't have justice, then we cannot expect people to make the types of sacrifices and commitments needed for, you know, for the future of this planet. So Sanders moves on both those fronts. He moves directly towards, you know, creating the infrastructure we need for sustainability, and he moves directly on creating the social infrastructure, which is a more equitable economy.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with economist Gerald Friedman about a report he wrote and released to CNN Money on the economic impact of a Bernie Sanders presidency. Now, I just want to ask one maybe theoretical question, which is, does one have to have growth of this kind in order to have prosperity?
No. I think that this plan and my analysis is operating within a framework where, you know, we have the 40-hour work week. You know, and I think that as we move forward, you know, if we had taken, as a country, if in 1970 we had decided, okay, We're not going to have increases in material consumption, but we're going to take productivity growth in the form of greater leisure time. We'd be working 20-hour weeks. Instead, what happened is we took almost all the increases in productivity in the forms of wealth for the wealthiest 5%, and the rest of us are actually working longer weeks than we were 40, 50 years ago. So most people got the worst of both worlds. I think over time, we want to take more and more of our increases in productivity in the forms of leisure. That's the way the world used to operate. You know, between, say, 1880 and 1940 or 1950, the average work week for Americans fell from over 60 to under 40. And it continued to fall for the next 20 years. You know, people were taking more leisure time. We were becoming richer, but we weren't doing it all in the forms of material consumption and other economic activity. Instead, we were doing more, you know, staying home, having more time with family, spending more time in school, retiring earlier. I think all those are great things, and we should be doing more of that. And they're also, generally speaking, more sustainable environmentally. I'm not assuming anything here about the work week. I'm kind of figuring that, okay, you know, just looking, because basically my whole analysis is tweaks on the Congressional Budget Office analysis. You know, because I wanted to stick as closely as possible to what the CBO is saying. I wanted this to be a very standard economic analysis, which I think it is. I didn't want somebody to be able to say that, oh, well, Friedman makes outrageous leftist assumptions because he's a, you know, he lives in Amherst. You know, instead, I wanted to keep this as close as possible to what the CBO was saying, except we have faster, more government spending, changes in taxes, a higher minimum wage, and some other things like that. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and, you know, but again, you know, shorter work weeks and changes in consumption can only happen in a more just country and a more just world. It's absolutely, you know, impossible to go to working people who are struggling and say, oh, well, you should take more leisure and accept lower income, while over there, those people, the IRS publishes the statistics on the 400 highest tax returns. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, these people average over $100 million per return. Those 400 people have as much income as, oh God, I forget the exact number. I figured it out. It's something like a quarter of the population. It's outrageous. It's so, you know, as long as those, you know, as long as so many people are struggling, environmentalists who say, well, we need to, you know, have, you know, have a lower standard of living, that, I mean, that just, like, you know, that doesn't work when you talk to people who are really struggling, and see around them, you know, people who are fabulously rich. You know, until we get things more balanced, it will be hard to move forward on, you know, what needs to be done, what my friend and colleague Julie Shaw talks about in reducing overconsumption. Yeah, that needs to happen, but it needs to start with the rich.
Well, Gerald Friedman, thank you so much. This has really been fascinating and a rich conversation. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, I much enjoy it. Thank you very much.
Gerald Friedman is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His work was the basis for attacks on Bernie Sanders in the Wall Street Journal, which the Clinton campaign has used and which Friedman has countered. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our previous interview with Gerald Friedman about his work on single-payer health insurance, which forms the basis for Senator Bernie Sanders' plan for Medicare for All. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice.